Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. This is the 20th episode of our history of the Catholic Church, and we've got as far as the 18th century. This is an amazingly tumultuous century. Again, as we've noticed, as we've gone through the history of the Catholic Church, what we've entitled this Triumphs and Tragedies, because it seems that the Church swings back and forth in God's providence from great triumphs to great tragedies, huge problems, and then huge solutions to the problems. And we're reminded that this progress is pendular. In other words, we like to think that progress is one steady climb up the mountain of success, but in fact, progress is always sort of two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward, one step back. And this is the case also with the history of the Catholic Church. So in order to help us to get the big picture and to see the overview, I'd like to go back and just remind you of what's happened over the last few centuries in this history of the Catholic Church. If we go back to the 16th century, we actually had so much happen during the 1500s that we had to take a couple of episodes to deal with it. And of course, the 1500s, the 16th century, is the age of the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, but also politically in Europe, a transformation and a break from the Middle Ages, which is going to have repercussions right down through the centuries that we're covering now, and also, of course, into the modern age. What happened in the 16th century is that the Protestant Reformation broke the unity between church and state, which was something which unified all of Europe into this unit we call Christendom, in which the nation states had a higher allegiance, and that was allegiance to the Catholic faith, which united everyone. At the Reformation, this was broken theologically, but it was also broken politically, because the different the rulers of the nation states began to take their allegiance according to the different religions. So the rulers of the German nation states, of course, went partially over to Lutheranism. In England, Anglicanism became the state religion. And this brought about the wars and the struggles in the years that came after. So we see the that sort of 500 year mark. First of all, in the overview, at 500 was the breakdown of the Roman Empire and the emergence of the Dark Ages. At the 1000. Mark, 500 years later, we see the great division between East and West, the Eastern Orthodox and the Western Church splitting, but also an emergence from the Dark Ages into the Middle Ages. And then 500 years later, in the 16th century, in the 1500s, we see the Protestant Reformation, when we move out of the Middle Ages and we begin to move into the age of what's called the Enlightenment. But I think that's a bit of a misnomer, because it's really an age of Europe beginning to break with its Christian past philosophically and culturally, and we see that break really coming to fruition now in the 18th century. So these 500 years between 1500 and the 20th century, between the two, we will see being an age of revolution, an age 500 years of revolution and war and bloodshed, which all began really with the Protestant Reformation, with this breaking of Christendom. And so as we look at over the broad view, we will look back and see these 500 years from 1500 to 2000 as being unbelievably tumultuous. And of course, we will see this in this episode, the 18th century. But first, I'd like to remind you that after the upheaval of the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s, then in the 1600s, in the 17th century, we see some of the triumph. We see the church swing back in with the Counter-Reformation and with the Council of Trent and the reforms in the liturgy and the reforms in the church, which really did take place, and the great missionary movement, the establishment of the Jesuits and the missionary efforts in the Far East and in the New World, and the establishment of new religious orders and a great fervor and a return to the faith in the 17th century, the Counter-Reformation. But now we move into the 18th century, and we'll see that while the Counter-Reformation continues its progress through this 18th century, we're going to see that actually it starts to dwindle and we fall back into a low point again in the history of the church. Remember in the last episode we talked about the conflict between the Jesuits and the Jansenists, and this theological conflict continues now into the 18th century, into the 1700s. And this conflict between Jansenists and Jesuits indicates a deeper conflict within the church herself, a conflict between extreme piety and devotion, with evidence by the Jansenists, and the other side of the equation, which is a Catholicism which is amenable to the world, which is a bit more easygoing, which understands human frailty and is adapting to the situations and the circumstances in which they find themselves. And this is a conflict which has always been there in the church, between a kind of exclusivism and a strict devotionalism and a piety, and a form of Catholicism which is at ease in the world and making compromises with the world and is politically correct and involved in this world much more than being concerned with the other world. And this is a conflict which we will see continues on through this 18th century, and then in the 19th, and now in the 20th, and now into our own age of the 21st century. So we're looking back and seeing some of these overviews and seeing what God is doing. And it's important because it helps us to understand what's happening in the church today in our own age, in now at the beginning of the 21st century. So if we see that, we need to understand and remember that during the 1700s, there are real currents within the thought of the day, and the rationalism of the Enlightenment and the philosophers of the Enlightenment are still making headway. They planted some real seeds in the 17th century, and now they're beginning to flourish as they work their way into society in the 18th century. And we'll see that, especially in France, the fruit of this humanistic and rationalistic thought is very destructive to the faith. What is happening now in the 18th century is that the old order, it really is continuing to break down. When I say the old order, I mean a union between church and state that existed in the Middle Ages. Was broken at the Reformation, but it's taking centuries now for it to really break down completely. We're going to see, remember, this is the century of the foundation of the United States of America, 1776, Declaration of Independence. It's in this time period that the thought of the rationalists in France and in England is part of the foundation philosophy and the foundation principles of the United States of America. And one of the big things in the United States, which Europe had never heard of before, was the idea of the separation of church and state. The idea that the state should be religiously neutral, there should not be a state religion. This was a novel and a revolutionary thought as the United States is founded. But we'll see from the events that are taking place in France why the turmoil and the wars of religion that had taken place in Europe pressure the founding fathers of America to make this radical step forward into separation of church and state. And this is one of the hallmarks of the United States and United States culture and religion, which separates it so much from Europe, even today, where the idea of an established church is still part of the culture in France and in England and in Germany and in Italy. It's still part of the history and part of the culture. And this is something we'll be talking about in future episodes as we move forward into the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries. So, In this 18th century, the 1700s, we are seeing the challenges of the union of church and state cropping up in the turmoil of European politics. Basically, what we have are a couple of different ruling powers that are dominating Europe, the Bourbons and the Habsburgs, the rulers of France, Spain, and Austria. They exert control over the church as well as over the state. These are Catholic powers, remember, but they're also vying for the power of the papacy, because the papacy still controls the papal states, controls territory in Italy, and the Pope is seen as one prince among many. He controls a large proportion of Italy, and the Habsburgs and the Bourbons are the royal families of France, Spain, and Austria who control their territories. Therefore, one of the things which happens during this century is that the powers of France, Spain, and Austria exert undue influence on the conclaves that are electing popes, and basically they vie for power and they get compromise candidates elected. Consequently, the eight popes during the 18th century, between 17 and 1800, with the exception of Benedict the 14th, all of the popes during this time period are weak, mediocre, very often old and infirm, and they're elected in the conclaves really in order to neutralize the power of the papacy. The consequence of this is that the popes really are weak, both theologically, intellectually, politically, and the power of the papacy just begins to go on a long, century-long slide right downhill. In the meantime, the different monarchies are colliding and are struggling for power, as they've always done across Europe. Remember, in the last episode, we talked about Gallicanism, and I want to just go back over that again because it sets the foundation for the terrible things that are going to be happening in France during this really upsetting century of the 18th century. And if you remember Louis the 14th, if you've ever been to Versailles, the great palace outside of Paris, this is the palace of the Sun King, and the French monarchy is at its height at this point. And Louis the 14th, he wants to assert his right to appoint bishops in France instead of the Pope. Why does he want to do this? Well, remember that if you're a bishop or an abbot, you get the income from the diocese or from the lands owned by the abbey, and therefore it's a plum job, and the king wants to have the right to appoint the bishops and the abbots, and the Pope is holding out and saying no, it's Pope Innocent the 11th, who was actually a good pope, and this is taking place at the end of the the 17th century. There's this clash between Louis the 14th and the Pope, and Pope Innocent defies Louis, and Louis the 14th then calls a council of clergy, and he enacts the four articles, and these four articles challenged papal authority, also said that the Pope was not infallible, said that invoked the Council of Constance. You might remember the Council of Constance was the one which ended the Great Schism when there were two and sometimes three popes, and so Louis and his counselors evoke the Council of Constance, saying that a council has more authority over the Pope, and this seriously weakens the authority of the Pope for the first time. across Europe, a Catholic monarch and a devoutly Catholic monarch is drawing the line and putting boundaries on the power of the Pope, especially over temporal concerns in France. Now, remember, in France, the clergy have extraordinary power because it's the established church, and the clergy are the ones who are educated. They're the ones who are controlling the universities and the schools. They have the power of censorship over books that are published. The clergy control all the record keeping for marriages and baptisms and deaths. And so they're like the civil servants of the state. They have enormous power. And the king is concerned to be able to have some control over that power. Eventually, the problem is resolved, and Louis backs away from the English solution. The English solution being the break with Rome that Henry VIII enacted, and Louis steps back from that. But the tensions between the French Church and the French monarchy and the Pope are still alive as we move into the 18th century. Now, a couple of other things are happening during this century, which are very important, and I'm afraid are part of the decline, part of the tragedy of the church in the 18th century. Because of the establishment of church and state, and because the Pope is still considered to be a prince among other princes in Europe, again, a certain amount of worldliness and a certain amount of decadence creeps into the church. Where there is power, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. You know the old saying. And so the papacy is weakened by this decadence, but also the initial fervor of the missionary movement begins to die out. The monasteries and religious life start to become comfortable and decadent again. And so during the 18th century, all of these corruptions and all of these weaknesses start creeping back. Human weaknesses start creeping back into the church. And part of that also has to do with a controversy with the Jesuits. Remember, during the 17th century, the Jesuits were the powerhouse of the church. They were the courageous missionaries who went out to the North America and South America, out to China and Japan and India, and were the courageous soldiers of Christ of the Counter-Reformation. However, by the 1700s, they were becoming increasingly unpopular. In France, the pious Jansenists accused the Jesuits of being liberal and too easygoing. At the same time, the Jesuits did not keep up with the latest competing philosophies of humanism and the growth of science and the growth of the new understanding of the Enlightenment. They didn't challenge that enough because they were busy elsewhere. In China, the Jesuits were accused of watering down the faith in order to win Chinese converts and adapting the Christian faith too much to the Chinese culture and the Chinese religion. And the Franciscans, and the Dominicans, who were also involved in missionary efforts, blamed the Jesuits for heresy and for weakening the faith by adapting too much to the culture. When I read about this, I was thinking of the Jesuits in the church today and how they are also blamed today for adapting the faith too much to the present culture in which we live, adapting to feminism, adapting to homosexualism, adapting to liberation theology, adapting to left-wing politics, adapting the faith to the culture in order to ostensibly to evangelize, but of course weakening the faith in the process. Well, they were accused of this in the 18th century in China. And so the Pope suppressed their missionary work in China. It was a very controversial thing to do. Many people think that that's why China is not totally Catholic today, is because the Pope in the 18th century suppressed the Jesuit missionary work. Well, that can be debated. But at the same time, there were conflicts with the Jesuits in the New World. The Jesuits were in conflict in Paraguay with the political powers of Spain and Portugal, and the Pope sent an envoy to sort out the problem. if you remember, it was very well expressed in that movie, The Mission, that the Jesuits were on the side of the Native Americans who they had set up in communes and plantations to actually be self-sufficient. They were competing with some of the imperial powers financially, and therefore the powers of France and Spain said to the Pope, suppress the Jesuits. They're fomenting rebellion amongst the Native peoples, and they're causing disloyalty and rebellion and bloodshed. And so, yielding to all of these powers, remember I said that the popes during this century were weak, and Pope Clement XIV in 1773 then suppresses the Jesuits. This is another black mark for the church in the 18th century, because the Jesuits really were, for all of their faults and all of their problems, were one of the great powerhouses in the church. Even then, the Jesuit general was imprisoned in Rome. He died in squalor, and it was a pretty great scandal that Pope Clement the 14th suppressed the Jesuits, especially, as most people said, that he suppressed the Jesuits because of political pressure. And when you read political pressure, you can hear economic pressure, which is another way of saying because of money and power. And so these low points in the 18th century combine to be one of the tragedies, one of the weaknesses of the church. We're going to see that it swings back again in the 19th century, just like it did in the 16th and 17th centuries. You've got this pendulum going back and forth. However, in this 1700s, we see a papacy that is weakened because of political influences and economic influences. We see the decadence in the religious orders. We see the decline of missionary efforts as the Franciscans, the Dominicans, and the Jesuits get embroiled in political controversy and get embroiled in other concerns rather than spreading the gospel. Meantime, the church continues to sort of wallow on in this being ensconced in the political powers of struggles of Europe, and being enmeshed with the church state politics. The Pope continues to try to maintain control over the increasingly shrinking papal states, the territory he controls in Italy. And so this is a low point, and the low point comes to a climax at the end of the 18th century, which with five of the most tumultuous and terrible years, not only in church history, but also in European history. And this is the terrible bloodshed and terrible revolution that takes place in France. And of course, the French Revolution had a huge impact on the church, not only in France, but the church all across Europe. So as Europe is going to go into the 19th century, the events in the French Revolution pull the rug out from under the Catholic Church in Europe and make the Pope and the Catholic powers reassess completely really what the church is all about and what the mission of the Catholic Church is in the world. And while this 18th century seems to be tragic, after we discuss the French Revolution here in just a minute, I'll share with you why I think that these things in God's providence are actually used for the best. But let's consider what happened in the French Revolution. The French Revolution was, in many ways, the climax of the Enlightenment. The rationalism and the humanism of the Enlightenment is the philosophical basis for the French Revolution. Now, the revolution begins as a nonviolent experiment. The king had gathered together 1,200 deputies who came to Versailles in order to solve a financial crisis. This is in the spring of 1789. And these 600 or so commoners, ordinary people, are called the Third Estate. And they suggest that there's more than just a financial crisis to be solved, and they want to replace the monarchy with a society based on the ideas of the Enlightenment, a democratic society, a republican society instead of a monarchy. And they want to bring about this reformation, and the first step they take is to declare that Louis the 16th, who's the king by this time, would no longer be allowed to rule as a monarch by divine right, but he has to share his power with representatives, kind of like a constitutional monarchy as they have in England, where there's a monarch, but there's also a parliament which is elected by the people. Well, the king resists this, but the Third Estate resists him. And finally, unable to use force and resist them, the king capitulates and allows them to meet as a national assembly. However, in the meantime, he's not really happy with this. He brings in some mercenary troops, and the people famously storm the Bastille, the fortress in France, and they form their own army called the National Guard, and around the country there's an uprising. And the king tries to deal with this with force and doesn't succeed and brings about his own execution. And at that point, the monarchy is abolished as the king is beheaded and the republic is established. Well, this revolution is really only beginning to get legs. In 1789, the whole ancient order of aristocracy and monarchy is beginning to tremble and beginning to crumble. Remember, I said that the priests were the registrars of births, marriages, and deaths. The church was actually very integrated into this establishment. And you would have thought, therefore, that there would be conflict between the revolution and the members of the church. But what happened was that the clergy, in fact, at the parish level, the lower clergy, were actually in favor of the revolution. And they sided against the nobility and the king in favor of the National Assembly. So it was looking good for the church to start with. But however, this National Assembly began to take up some reforms of the church as well as reforms of the state. Because remember, you don't have separation of church and state. And so if they're going to bring in a reform and a new kind of government, a new kind of society, they have plans to reform the church as well. And so they... Also, everyone admitted that there was many reforms that were long overdue. There needed to be reform in the way the clergy were paid, the way the property was managed, the way the church property was kept and used for the people. There was reform to get rid of all of the wealthy sort of positions that were there for cathedral clergy and bishops and abbots and so forth, where they were continuing to get all this income. That needed to be reformed, and many people thought that the reforms were good. But the decrees of the rebels started to go a little bit further, because they wanted to eliminate also the Pope from any internal affairs in the church in France, and they wanted to elect the bishops and the priests just like any other civil servants by the people. And finally, they took the step which forced the hand of the Catholic clergy. The rebels tried to force the clergy to accept the radical reforms by imposing on them an oath of allegiance, or an oath of compliance. You might remember a very similar thing happened in the 16th century in England, where Henry VIII forced all of the clergy to take an oath of allegiance, and then his daughter Elizabeth I did the same thing. And the oath of allegiance to the king instead of to the Pope was the crunch point for many of the Catholic clergy. They'd seen what happened in England. In this case, the oath of allegiance or oath of compliance isn't to the king, but it's to the revolution as opposed to the Pope. Well, a compromise might have been worked out, but the rebels were not really interested in a compromise. In Austria, Joseph II, a pious monarch, had reformed the church. In Russia, Catherine II had reorganized the Polish diocese. And so it was possible for reform of the church by the secular power to take place, but the revolutionaries were not interested in this, and they insisted on the clergy making their oath of compliance. So the clergy were left with only one alternative. They appealed to the Pope to see whether it was legitimate for them to accept the oath of compliance. By this time, the Pope was Pius VI, and he himself viewed himself as an absolute monarch in Italy, and was looking down his nose on the French Revolution. He took 8 months to come to a decision. And then finally, on March 10th, 1791, he issued a condemnation of the oath of compliance, and he ordered the French clergy not to take the oath. But a few months earlier, the French clergy had already been forced to make up their own minds. And in January of 1791, they were presented with the oath of compliance, and all but seven of the bishops and about half of the clergy rejected the oath. Therefore, the French clergy, the French church, was in a kind of state of internal schism. Some of the clergy took the oath of compliance, and they argued that they were simply being good citizens and that they were in favor of the proper kind of reforms for the church. Spiritually, they said they were still in allegiance to the Pope, but in secular matters, they complied with the rules of the French Revolution. So in this state of confusion and ambiguity, there was great chaos in the church. So it was like two Catholic communities existed together in almost every town and village. You had the constitutional church, which was led by the bishops and the clergy who took the oath, and they were installed into their posts. But then there were the non-constitutional, or what was called the non-juring clergy, and they remained loyal to Rome, and they became a kind of underground church. And the people, of course, were therefore divided. Those who went with the constitutional church, the clergy and the bishops who took the oath, and those who went underground and, like the recusants in England, began to operate undercover as the Catholics who remained loyal to Rome. The same thing that we've seen in China, where there was the state-sponsored church, a Catholic church, and then there was the underground church, which remained loyal to Rome the whole time. And so this is happening in France in the 18th century, and it's something which has happened in various other places around the world. So at first, the non-constitutional priests were ejected from their rectories and their churches, but eventually they were seen to be sympathetic with the aristocrats who were against the revolution. Therefore, the handwriting was on the wall for them, because the ones who did not accept the constitution were assumed to be enemies of the revolution, and therefore on the side of the aristocrats and the nobility, all of whom were going to be imprisoned and were going to lose their head. Well, finally, it comes to a crisis, because in 1792, 1 year later, the forces of Austria and Prussia planned to invade France and overturn the revolution. And when this happened, every non-juring priest, everyone who did not take the oath, was denounced. If they were denounced by 20 active citizens, they were to be deported. So some 30,000 to 40,000 priests were driven out of their towns and hounded into hiding or exile. And a few months later, a year later, in 1793, the death penalty was imposed on any of them who dared to return. So, at the height of the Reign of Terror, a good number of the non-jurors, the ones who did not take the oath, remained and exercised their ministry in secret, even though to do so was to risk death. And the parallels, therefore, with the recusants in England under the Elizabethan regime are very similar. The underground church and priests, heroic priests, risking their lives to administer the sacraments. So, as the Duke of Brunswick approached Paris with the Prussian troops, the city went into panic, and they rushed to the prisons, and they pulled out all those who were in prison for being opposed to the revolution, and that's when the priests began to lose their head. 30 bishops and 220 priests lost their lives. In the meantime, everything seemed safe for the constitutional clergy, the ones who had conformed and taken the oath of alliance. So oath of compliance to the revolution. However, increasingly, the rebels began to view all of the clergy as being on the side of the ancient regime, on the side of the nobility, on the side of the Pope, on the side of the old order. And increasingly the tide began to turn, and as it did, the revolution itself began to take a kind of religious nature to itself. The patriotic ceremonies featured sacred oaths and sacred trees. The localities gave patriotic names to the towns and streets instead of the names of saints. Church bells and chalices and sacred vessels were seized and melted down, and the tensions began to grow between the revolutionaries, who were increasingly un-Christian, and the church itself. The next step was that the Republic changed the calendar in October of 1793. They changed all of the Christian days of the week. They put in a new pagan day of the week. They started a new era from the beginning of the French Republic instead of from the birth of Christ. In September 1792, this was the beginning of a new age in France, which was un-Christian. The second move to remove Christianity completely from France starts with the agents of the National Convention. These were men who were sent out with unlimited powers to deal with the emergency that was created by the invasion of France by Prussia and what they saw as the counter-revolution. In other words, there was going to be a backlash, and it was a fanatical, bloodthirsty backlash, in which they eventually went through all of the churches of the land and turned them into temples of reason and presided over with ceremonies that caricatured the Catholic liturgy. The clergy were pressured to marry, and even the ones who took the oath of compliance now were seen to be the enemy. Christian doctrine was overturned, Christian education was forbidden, and a new religion was put in its place, the religion of reason, the religion of humanity, the religion of humanism. And various different rebels rose up and began to change everything to this bizarre religion of reason. In 1794, cathedrals and parish churches of most towns and temples were turned into temples of reason, and in Notre Dame Cathedral, for instance, an actress was enthroned on the high altar as reason's great goddess. A lot of priests and bishops abandoned their ministry, and to indicate that they married. In Beauvais, in France, 15 priests and bishop all married in 1803. A total of 50 of the 480 priests had done so. Some of the renegades priests willingly defrocked themselves and took a lead in the de-Christianization and rebelled against the church. Numbers are uncertain, but they think that the number of priests who left because of the persecutions or willingly would be about 20,000. And most of them were the ones who had complied to the Constitution, and so they were for an easier target because they had already, if you like, compromised at that earlier stage. So when this extreme de-Christianization and persecution of the church came in, they were already weakened and were very, very susceptible to fall. Well, the rulers of the revolution understood that you can't have no religion at all, so they created other forms of new religions. Robespierre, for instance, found the worship of reason too close to atheism, so he devised something called the Cult of the Supreme Being, and he carried this through in 1793 and had it imposed on all of France. He envisaged this as a religion that would be all-embracing and would gather Catholics and Protestants around the same altar, and it would have only one dogma, the immortality of the soul, and only one precept, do your duty as a man. So he wanted to impose this rationalistic, humanistic religion on France. He even created a liturgy, which was inaugurated on a beautiful day in June in 1794. He dressed himself up as the high priest in a sky blue coat, it says, and with his hair carefully powdered, and led a procession from through France with bouquets of berries, grain, and flowers, and the people sang Republican hymns, and after a sermon, Robespierre ignited a cardboard figure labeled atheism. When it crumpled, out of its ashes stepped another figure representing human wisdom. Well, the whole Robespierre himself died shortly after, and with him, this fake religion fell by the wayside. And by 1794, the whole thing had fizzled out, and in 1795, in February, a new decree came out guaranteeing the exercise of free religion in France, and the churches were opened up again. So, from 1789 to 1795, just 6 short years, all of this happened in France, which was a huge upheaval for not only the church, but for French culture, and most importantly, for the establishment of the Catholic faith in Europe. What happened in France was to really pull the rug out from European Catholicism once and for all. Meantime, in the United States, the idea of separation of church and state is beginning to come to fruition, and we're going to see how this lays a foundation for what happens in the 19th and then in the 20th centuries. Well, at the very moment that the Catholic Church in France seemed about to be revived, something else happens, which is strikes at the person of the Pope himself. By this time, Napoleon has come to power, and he begins a campaign to conquer Italy. In 1796, 1 year after the Declaration of Freedom of Religion, Napoleon occupies Milan and a number of the individual republics in northern Italy, and he sets up a French form of republican government. He spares Rome, but in December 1797, a French general is assassinated by the Pontifical Guard, and Napoleon uses that as an excuse to march into Rome. He not only marches into Rome, but he takes Pius VI as a prisoner. And he directs his general to remove the Pope to France so that the Austrians might not rescue him. And the Pope, who was 81 years old, dies on the journey in Valence. This brings us to the end of the 18th century, and the conclave for the election of the next Pope opens on November 30th, 1799, in Venice. And it's under the protection of the Emperor of Austria because of the instability in Rome, and Benedict, the Benedictine Bishop of Imola, is chosen after a long conclave, and he is Pope Pius VII. And Pope Pius VII, it turns out, will just have the right combination of qualities to meet the increasing crisis in the church. Well, we're going to leave it there. Napoleon, in June of 1800, defeats the Austrians at the Battle of Marengo, and he becomes the master of Italy. And we'll pick this up next time in the next episode of Triumphs and Tragedies, where we have Napoleon beginning to be the master of Italy and leading us, therefore, into the 19th century. What do we learn from the church in the 18th century? Well, we learn that the union of church and state, which had really been established way back in the 4th century by Constantine and was assumed to be one of the givens in European culture and in the Catholic Church, that the Pope would also have temporal power of some sort, or he would be in alliance with the temporal powers, he would be in cooperation and working with the secular powers, that this is beginning to erode and is beginning to evaporate. And it seems to be a huge crisis for the Catholic Church. The French Revolution, and before that the Protestant Reformation, had gradually been nibbling away at this, but now in the 18th century we see it crumbling, and with the weakening of the papacy and the political events in Europe, we see this divergence between the spiritual and the secular in the church. What does it say about where we are in the 21st century now? Well, you know, we still have this struggle. We still have a brand of Catholics who think that the mission of the church is to change this world. Remember Augustine's division between the city of God and the city of man, and the question of just how the church does interact and influence politics and influence the secular, the political powers. You have the two extremes, those who want to pull out, kind of like the Amish, and say, no, we're only a spiritual church. We have nothing to do with political power. And then you have the other extreme where they're saying, no, the church's role is to be at the heart of politics, at the heart of the public square, and to be involved in these debates. It's a debate which is never going to go away, but it's a debate which goes to the very heart of what the Christian gospel is about, because the Christian gospel is essentially about the declaration of the good news. And Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. Therefore, we have to consider in our own day how much we actually expect to influence and change the world, or how much we do what Rodrera calls the Benedict option, where we see ourselves as a city set on a hill, as a society set apart, as a spiritual community, which functions instead as the spiritual heart of society, rather than being involved in society and changing society on the outside. I don't propose to have all the answers for that. I know what my particular beliefs are, and I'm on the side of Rod Dreher and the Benedict option. I'm a Benedictine oblate myself, and I believe that it is by renewing the heart and the soul of our church and our faith and our families and our parishes that we actually effect the most power and change in the world anyway. And that if we try to do the other and get too involved in political politics and too involved in the issues of the world, we get sidetracked from our true mission, which is to be the heart of love and the breath of the Holy Spirit in the world, which brings Jesus Christ right into the midst of it, not so much as the master of this world, but as the heart and as the light of the world, which he claims to be. Thank you for listening to Triumphs and Tragedies. I hope that you've enjoyed the podcast series so far. I've enjoyed making the podcast. We're going to have just two or three more sessions to cover the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries, and then we'll be finished. But I do have some other podcast projects planned. Some of them are actually fiction, where I'll be telling some stories, and I'm experimenting with a new idea of doing a podcast novel, and these things will be coming up over the fall. You'll be able to always listen on my blog and my iTunes channel. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.